Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Millions of American retirees and would-be retirees are getting a rude wake-up call these days. They may have already booked tee time for 18 holes of golf in Florida or been dreaming of quality afternoon time with the grandkids. Instead, they're on the job. The stock market swan dive has gutted the savings of many older Americans now in their golden years. They're setting the alarm clock, brewing the coffee, and heading back to work again tonight on Point, Unretired America. We begin with Britain's new ultimatum for Saddam Hussein in the House of Commons today. Prime Minister Blair outlined six demands that Saddam Hussein must meet to avert war. James Blitz is political editor with the Financial Times. I asked him how he would interpret what Tony Blair is trying to accomplish with his new set of demands.
What he's trying to do is to get a majority of 9 out of the 15 on the Security Council before a vote takes place, either tomorrow, Thursday, or on Friday. The situation basically is there's a middle ground of countries like Chile, Mexico, Pakistan, which need to have sort of additional assurances before they decide to vote in favor of a second resolution. And basically by spelling out a list of additional things that Saddam Hussein and Iraq have to do before a deadline, which is not yet specified, he hopes he can bring those countries on board, though I think it's going to be difficult.
Are these meetable demands? Is there an expectation that Saddam Hussein might, in fact, respond to each and every one of these? Or is this camouflage that lets wavering countries come on board with the United States and the UK?
They're pretty daunting demands, to be honest. I mean, the first of the demands is that Saddam Hussein should make a televised broadcast inside his own country in Arabic, that he has weapons of mass destruction, and that he tends to destroy them. That is a pretty tough demand, I imagine, for the Iraqi regime, because it would be a humiliating blow for Saddam Hussein in front of his own people. So at least that demand, anyway, is tough. There are other demands as well. They have to explain what they've done with the anthrax supplies, which were part of the sort of UNSCOM leftovers, as they're called, from 1998. They have to account for what they've done with the drones, the unmanned aircraft which can drop chemical weapons. So there's a lot that they have to do.
But all of these might be less humiliating than defeat in war.
Yes, of course, they might be less humiliating than that. But the fact is that at least the first of those demands, the public address by Saddam Hussein in front of his own people, would be a pretty humiliating move. And it would be very difficult, I think, as far as British officials are concerned, to imagine that Saddam Hussein could easily survive if he were to give way to a demand like that.
There's some analysis in the U.S. today that, in fact, this is Tony Blair attempting to wriggle out of war, to find a path away from attack and invasion.
That's definitely not the case. The Prime Minister was absolutely clear in the House of Commons today when answering questions from MPs that he's going to stick to the course which he's been setting out for the past 7 months. There was a suggestion by Donald Rumsfeld yesterday in Washington that the U.S. might actually end up going alone, that the U.K. might back out of a military attack if it came to it. The Prime Minister clearly put that down. He said that he was going to stick to the path that he'd set himself, that the U.N. had to meet the obligations which it set itself in Resolution 1441.
But is there a gap opening here, however subtle, between Washington and London, between the Bush and Blair teams? Can Tony Blair take the U.K. into this war without himself being thrown out of office?
Well, is there a gap emerging between the U.S. and the U.K.? I don't think so. I think, from the way it's seen here in London, the U.S. is making pretty clear that a second resolution has to be voted on one way or the other, or a decision has to be taken on whether to table it or not, by the end of Friday. I think that's absolutely clear from this end. I don't think a gap, and that is obviously putting some pressure on the British, but I don't think there's any gap emerging between the U.S. and U.K. positions.
And if that authorization is not forthcoming, if the vote cannot be won, can Tony Blair take the U.K. To war alongside the United States anyway or not?
Yes, he can. What would basically happen is that the Prime Minister would send troops into battle. That's the first stage. There would then be a vote on a substantive motion in the House of Commons to approve the sending of troops. There would be a substantial rebellion by his Labour Party inside the House of Commons. Around 160 of the 410 Labour MPs would vote against that motion, and the motion would be carried with the support of the Conservatives, who favour confronting Saddam Hussein in this way. Nevertheless, although the war will be prosecuted, will come to an end, it would be a highly difficult period for Mr. Blair, and his long-term future would not be assured.
How did Blair and the British political circles take Donald Rumsfeld's suggestion that the U.S. could invade Iraq alone if political pressures made it impossible for Blair to join?
Well, it was an important moment in the sense that I think when Mr. Rumsfeld said what he said, he opened the possibility for Mr. Blair to turn around today and say, well, actually, there is a possibility that we may not join. And so that he did create, Mr. Rumsfeld, inadvertently or not, quite a delicate moment for the British government. But the fact is that Mr. Blair completely turned around today and said he's going ahead with it anyway. He did not take the opportunity to back out, which the U.S. Defense Secretary had opened up for him.
So as you read it, James Blitz, Tony Blair remaining a solid ally attempting to get U.N. authorization on the way to invasion, unless the off chance occurs that Baghdad should comply with the whole half dozen.
Yes. If there are 9 votes in the Security Council in favor of a second resolution, I think his position is made a good deal easier. The likelihood, I think, is, at least as seen from London, that there aren't going to be those 9 votes. He's going to have a tremendously difficult situation in the Commons, in British politics, over the next few weeks. There's no question about that. But I'm in no doubt that the Prime Minister will throw his weight behind military action against Iraq. That I'm absolutely sure of.
James Blitz is political reporter with the Financial Times. He spoke with us earlier from London. Wall Street's bubble burst, and millions of American retirees who had saved and invested for their golden years have watched with despair as their nest eggs have cracked. Now, American seniors are sending out their resumes, abandoning newfound hobbies and interviewing for jobs. While the economy has forced many Americans out of the workforce, retirees are flooding back in, many out of necessity. A recent survey by the AARP found that more than a quarter of Americans between 50 and 70 years old who lost money in the stock market say their losses are changing their work plans and not in the direction of golf. Some are picking up an old practice. Some are settling for minimum wage. Some are pounding the pavement. Are you back to work after retirement and shocked that you've had to make that move? Did you plan to retire by now and instead find yourself working, working, working? What's it like to be 60 plus, 70 plus, 80, and still punching the clock? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Kevin Cahill, Associate Director for Research at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Good evening and welcome, Kevin Cahill.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. And with us from Arlington, Virginia, is Claire Hushbeck, a Senior Legislative Representative for the AARP and a labor economist. Good evening and welcome, Claire Hushbeck.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Kevin Cahill, I'm looking here at a chart, and I know this isn't the only factor at play here, but it shows a kind of fever line of the stock market headed down, jagged downward trend, and almost a mirror image is the number, the percentage of elders in America coming into the stock market, an increase almost mirroring that downtrend in the stock market. Is that what's behind all this?
Yeah, the graph you're referring to is fairly striking. But I think it's also helpful to look at these retirement trends in a historical perspective.
Okay, good.
If you look at retirement trends in the last 100 years, mm-hmm. you see amongst men a gradual decline, progressing slowly to around the mid-1980s.
A decline in the age of retirement or the percentage of people that were working above a certain age, or what exactly?
Labor force participation rates.
All right.
So we see a decline in labor force participation rates mm-hmm. until the mid-1980s, mm-hmm. at which point they level off.
Okay.
This is amongst men. Mm-hmm. So something happened in the mid-1980s, and that steadiness in the labor force participation rates held until around 2000. Then in the last 3 years or so, we see this pronounced increase in labor force participation rates to the graph that you just mentioned. And what's pretty striking there is that this increase in labor force participation rates has occurred at a time when the economy is slowing. What we've seen in the past is in times of recession the last 40 years, excluding the current one.
Recession, therefore fewer jobs.
Right. We see that labor force participation rates amongst older men have declined by 0.2 percentage points.
Historically.
So a small amount, and it's gone down.
Mm-hmm.
Here we see increases in labor force participation on the order of 3 percentage points between January 2001 and January 2003.
Which you point out in a report from your group is an epical scale of change, the biggest change in the post-war history.
Yes, that is correct.
And reversing a century's trend, essentially, toward less participation in the workforce by American seniors.
Yes. What we would have expected to see in a downturn is fewer older individuals working. And what we're seeing here is the exact opposite, is more individuals working. And the big question is, why is that happening? And there's many, many reasons why. One that we've recently wrote about here at the Center for Retirement Research has been this shift from defined benefit to defined contribution pension plans.
Those words go by so quickly, but they have huge meaning. Defined benefit was you worked and you knew what you'd get. The company made a commitment in the retirement payout to you. Defined contribution only defines what you put in, but there's no guarantee what you'll take out when you retire.
That's correct. So under the defined contribution world, we see individuals are much more susceptible to market vulnerability.
This is essentially the 401k world.
That is correct. So we see that individuals are susceptible to market fluctuations, and what's happened in the last couple of years is that the market has gone down, and as a result, individuals have much less income in their retirement years.
And it hurts, and they go back to work. Claire Hushbeck, you at the AARP pay close attention to this group. It's your bread and butter.
Yes, indeed.
What are you hearing? I mean, we're getting the numbers here, and we're told that they are historic numbers and reversing historic trends. Is that the picture, the buzz, the out there in the world of the AARP American that jobs are back front and center?
More than people would wish, yes. The reason we undertook our survey back in November and December of 2002 among people who own stocks aged 50 to 70 was because we were getting an enormous number of anecdotal bits of evidence coming in over the transom, so to speak. People calling saying, what do I do? I retired last year or the year before, and I put all my money into a basket of stocks because they were doing well, and I took this buyout plan from my employer, and now here I am. What can I do?
So when people have to go back to work, what kind of work are they turning to, Claire?
Well, the answer varies tremendously depending on several factors. One, how recently did they leave the workforce? Two, what is their age? Which there are correlated, of course. And three, you know, what is their skill kit, so to speak? But I think many people are going back to work only part-time, maybe, as a way to sort of patch the holes until things get better, we hope. So a lot of people are not necessarily returning to their career jobs. And,
you know, I've got to tell you, Claire, just anecdotally, when I buy groceries, there are any number of wonderful older people there now working as cashiers, working bagging groceries.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wouldn't guess to their face, but between you, me, and the world, they look 70-plus easily, and I say that with full respect. And I think to myself, you know, the first sack of potatoes or or a cluster of bananas of the day is probably easy, but after several hours when you're 70-something and you're, you know, taking all those groceries over the scanner, putting them in the bag, I mean, in some ways it's a delight to have them there. They bring something else to the atmosphere that I haven't seen in that kind of environment in a while, but it must be hard, just physically difficult.
I think you can probably imagine that for the large majority of those people, they would rather not be doing that. These are people probably who have very few options and probably didn't have all that much anyway to be losing in the stock market, but whatever they had was very precious to them.
Is this the trend? Are we going to see more older Americans at the checkout line, at the doctor's office, you name it?
I don't know. I hope not. I hope people have a better ability to sort of plan ahead so that they are not necessarily in some of the most onerous and physically demanding jobs, which certainly this qualifies as.
And yet I wonder, boomers are famously under-savers. Kevin Cahill, Claire Hushbeck, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the unretired America, the unprecedented flood of older Americans headed back into the workforce. American seniors, are you back in the workforce and shocked to be there? Did you plan to retire by now and instead find yourself working? What's it like to be 60 plus, 70 plus, 80, and still punching the clock? You can join us tonight. please do at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American retirees rejoining the workforce, staying in the workforce, many out of necessity. Some are picking up an old practice. Some are settling for minimum wage. Some are pounding the pavement. You can join our conversation tonight. American seniors, are you back in the workforce and shocked to be there? Is it killing you? Is it depressing? Or does it keep you going emotionally and financially? You can join us tonight, and we hope you will, at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Kevin Cahill, Associate Director for Research at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, and from Arlington, Virginia tonight by Claire Hushbeck, Senior Legislative Representative at the AARP. She's a labor economist. Earlier today, I spoke with Carolyn Brady, a Boise, Idaho bookkeeper who retired nearly 5 years ago, but ill-timed investments wiped out her nest egg, so she went back to work. I asked her how she lost her savings.
What I did is I took it into pre-IPOs and invested not conservatively like I should have at my age.
Pretty aggressively. And what happened to that nearly $250,000?
I have not seen a penny of it.
So you had taken early retirement. That didn't work out when the money went away. You worked for a Utah utility for a couple of decades. What are you doing now, Carolyn Brady?
Right now I'm working at Walmart in their cash office. You know, we do deposits. We get the bags ready for the cashiers. It's a little like accounting, but it isn't.
Is it a 9-to-5 job, Carolyn?
No, it is not.
What are your hours now?
Mainly, I work in the evenings, mm-hmm. afternoons and evenings, but to get the job, I was very flexible. I said I was available 24 hours a day.
You're kind of starting over in a way. You're living with your sister in a Boise suburb?
That's correct, in a Boise suburb, Eagle, Idaho. Definitely, I would not be able to make it on my own right now.
Did you ever expect that at 58 years of age, after an early retirement, you'd be back at work at Walmart, living with your sister, kind of hand to mouth?
Never, because I'm a very independent person. Never in my wildest dreams did I think I'd be in this position.
When you look across the staff at the Walmart there, Carolyn, are there other seniors among the workforce there?
Yes.
Many?
Yes, there is. I would say in my area there isn't, but there is a sprinkle of seniors that perhaps they do not have quite the story that I have, but certainly they did not save enough or they lost some. Because you do see a fair amount of going back to work my age or older at Walmart.
And at this point, how long do you reckon you may work, Carolyn?
Right now, I can't even think of retirement because I'm living hand to mouth. With what I'm making, it's going to be the rest of my life.
I hate to rub it in, but an awful lot of people are dealing with this. What had you planned on doing at this age and later? What had you dreamed of doing?
Well, actually, the early retirement was something that I was not planning on. Actually, I enjoyed working, and so in my mind, I thought I was going to work until 65.
Mm-hmm. And after 65?
Then definitely I was going to retire and have a nice nest egg and be able to do what I enjoy doing and helping other people.
What would your ideal retirement year or years look like, Carolyn?
My ideal would be certainly being self-sufficient, which I'm not now, and it would not have been much different than how I lived before. How I lived before is I was conservative, I was able to save money, and I was able to help people.
And
that
would
have been my retirement.
And how do you feel about the events as they've actually turned out? Are you bitter? Or are you just resigned to doing it this way? Is it okay?
No, it isn't okay. Everything in my life has been turned upside down. Not one thing in my life has not needed to be fixed, emotionally and everything, but I can't carry the bitterness over because that will ruin my life. So I'm trying to just put one foot in front of the other and go on.
Carolyn Brady, we wish you the best with the path you're on.
Thank you.
Carolyn Brady is a back-to-work retiree in Boise, Idaho. We're talking tonight about unretired America, the unprecedented flood of older Americans headed back into the workforce. You can join the conversation. Did your retirement go down the drain with Wall Street? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Claire Hushbeck, give us a little analysis of what you just heard there from Boise and our guest, Carolyn Brady. Is this a familiar story to you at this point?
Yes, it is. Many people who have accepted early retirement offers in the last several years had not intended to be retiring maybe as early as their late 50s, but were either given an offer that sounded really, really good in light of 25% annual returns in the stock market, or offers that they didn't feel they could afford to refuse because they might get the axe anyway, because it's been steadily a trend towards downsizing in American business. So. Some of this retirement was not really predicated on planning to retire at that age. That is where people can really end up short, as Carolyn Brady has experienced. And a big part of this is the cost of health for seniors in particular. And if people don't have good retiree health benefits from their employers and they're not yet 65 when Medicare kicks in, then they can have a very long patch in there where their bills can be outrageous, even if they're in sort of nominally good health. So you throw that into the equation, and then if you don't have your, you don't own your home, and you don't have a good solid defined benefit pension, as was referred to just a few minutes ago
right.
by Kevin.
And before you know it, you're back at work.
There you are. That's right.
And maybe not having, maybe not covering the bases, even with work. Kevin Cahill, I was struck by one thing there. Here, Carolyn Brady had $253,000 in her nest egg. She had invested it in pre-IPOs. I mean, this is really playing the edge of market capitalism. Did seniors, as a rule, or those who are now working, were they greater risk takers, or were they simply people who got into streams of American life, maybe unlike Carolyn, that simply didn't provide for a retirement one way or another?
Well, I think it's, when I hear Carolyn's story, I think of the sources of retirement income and how that's changed and how that's likely to remain different from now on. Typically, retirement income is thought of as a three-legged stool. There are sources of income are Social Security, private pensions, and personal savings. What we're seeing now is that there's actually a fourth leg to the stool, and that's earnings.
Right.
And it's important to keep in mind that earnings can be a steady source of income for individuals that, that need it.
But maybe that's a fourth leg, or maybe it's still three, because as you point out, pensions are simply not as common, and defined benefit pensions in particular, as they once were.
Pensions overall have remained at around 50% of the workforce is covered by a pension.
At this point.
Right. It's the type of pension that's changed, and that's been this shift from the traditional defined benefit plans, which offer an annuity when an individual retires, versus these defined contribution 401k type plans, which have a lump sum of money that an individual receives at the time of retirement. And that shifts the risk of retirement income from the employer to the employee. And what we see is that the employee is very susceptible to market fluctuations. And that, as what happened to Carolyn, you can have, you know, vast sways in your retirement income sources.
Are we seeing here, then, is it possible to paint a picture of a typical defined benefit pension recipient and a typical 401k person? I guess it's not, because 401ks can have $10,000 in them or $100 million
that's
them.
That's correct.
But on balance, are defined benefit retirees in better shape today?
I guess the answer is yes. The people, individuals with defined benefit plans who've retired the last 3 years have maintained their benefits into retirement. They weren't vulnerable.
Stock market down doesn't matter.
Exactly. Whereas defined contribution plans, that income is susceptible to market fluctuation as long as if it's invested in equities, I must say.
Suzanne's calling from Litchfield, New Hampshire. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening.
It sounds like you just put my name in there and it still sounds the same.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, I guess, Suzanne. What's your story?
Oh, gosh, how far back should I go?
Well, give us the retirement part.
Well, I'm still not retired, actually. I've been an organist all my life.
Okay.
It's been a blessing.
Yes.
No matter where we moved with my husband's work. I got sick and was forced to to retire, short-term, long-term disability.
This, your husband, that was?
Yes, right.
Yes.
In 1989. And so our focus sort of changed financially at that time.
Mm-hmm. How old are you now, Suzanne?
I'm going to be 67 in April 17th of this year.
And are you still working?
Unfortunately, besides doing my church work, I'm back in the kitchen again at the school. And it does hurt to be on for like 3 or 4 hours at a time.
At the kitchen at school, in other words, serving lunch to kids, school kids?
And cleaning pots and pans again.
At 67.
I started doing this in 1966. I like to be available and on around the kids and
sure.
My grandchildren.
Of course.
So I focus that as most of my job as in the church.
Suzanne,
so,
if you don't mind, what do you take home a week from your school job?
$125 a week.
And is that critical money to you and your husband at this point?
Well, my husband passed away. That's the other part of the story.
I'm sorry.
April 1st of 95,
okay.
Which left me at 59 with no income, and pension got cut in half that he was receiving from work.
Right.
And that really scared me. Now, my children and grandchildren, we were still all together, so we stayed together financially that made it work.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a train collector, which was so exciting for us because that was going to be our retirement. And that
this
year
is model trains, do you mean, Suzanne?
Oh, yes, all kinds.
Yeah.
He used to make the boiler fronts and things. Well, that money, he's helped keep me alive, financially that year because I had to sell his collection.
Suzanne, let me ask, how long do you think you'll go on working?
Well, with my financial status, I'm in a debt repayment plan at this time, and they say I've got about 52 months that I have to make sure I keep working.
Let's see. At age 67, that takes you well into
70s. 72, yeah, 71, 72.
And is it all right, or do you curse your fate every day when you pull up those dirty pots to scrub?
Well, it's a test of your spirit, which I appreciate. As much as it hurts, and I have to laugh at myself, actually, after I sit down and try to get back up. And it's always nice, like I say, it's Wednesday night, Friday's almost here, but sooner or later it'll be Monday, right?
and 67, and looking forward to that Friday. Suzanne, we thank you for sharing your story, and we appreciate the spirit we can hear you bringing to it, even if it isn't the path you would have drawn for yourself. Thank you for calling.
Thank you so much for listening.
We've got Christopher Hyatt on the line, joining us from Eugene, Oregon. He's 62. He was and is an ear, nose, and throat doctor. He retired. He's come back to work. Good evening and welcome, Christopher Hyatt.
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for joining us. Tell us your story. Why did you retire? Why did you come back?
Well, I've got a lot of outside interests, and I thought I had enough money to get by,
mm-hmm.
and I depend only on my own IRA pension plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was prepared for maybe a 20% hit, but I took a 40% hit.
Now, why did that happen? Because the stock market didn't fill the bucket you thought it would?
Well, I thought that I could live off of my IRA holdings.
And interest income.
A certain amount of income. So
yes.
My draw from my IRA pension plan was reduced 40%.
Christopher Hyatt, we've just been talking with a woman in New Hampshire you might have heard who's gone back to work. She washes pots and pans at the school lunch counter for $120-some a week. I'm guessing as an ear, nose, and throat guy, you're in a different situation. So this wasn't that you had to work to eat, but what was it? It just hit your lifestyle in a way that you weren't prepared to accept?
Well, I'm kind of spoiled, and I am one of the lucky ones, but 40% decline is significant, I was lucky enough that my group had not filled my position, and I was able to get a job to go back half-time. So that gives me a source of income and gives me a way to fight back a little bit.
And how does it feel to be back at work? Is it all right? You're not old. You're 62. But are you cursing and wishing you were on the golf course or happy to
not
be there?
Not at all. I'm one of the lucky guys here, and I'm nowhere near what's going on in your other part of the program. But I'm only going back half-time, and I still have time to do a lot of the outside interests that I have developed over the last 20 years.
And what's your guess about how long you might keep it up, staring into those eyes and noses and throats?
Well, I sort of thought subconsciously that my stocks were sort of like freeze-dried vegetables and that they would sort of spontaneously rehydrate. But
yes.
actually, I think that it's going to be a few years. I've signed a contract till I'm 65. At that point, I'll have Social Security, and we'll take a look around and see what the story is.
But I guess I hear you saying, in no small part, it depends on whether or not the stock market comes back.
Sure. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And people say that could take a long time. I'm sorry to report that, but,
we are being told that. I had this sort of subconscious fantasy that this was all going to reverse itself, but that's not going to happen. And I'm adjusting to a lower lifestyle, but I'm still doing fine. I'm having fun, and I'm doing a job that's fun.
I guess it's one thing about having to go back to work when you're older. You bring some maturity to it.
Well, I've learned some stuff over the last 30 years, and I hope I can help out people with what I've learned. And the job is fun, and I'm not wearing a beeper, so I'm not one beep away from the emergency room at all times, which makes it more enjoyable.
Things to be thankful for. Christopher Hyatt in Eugene, Oregon, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks.
Claire Hushbeck, you're listening again. What do you hear in these stories of Suzanne with her pots and pans, of Christopher Hyatt going back to his medical practice part-time?
Well, he's very fortunate, as he is quite clear about, and it's nice to know that he knows that. The two women are in a situation that, of course, is the kind of story that we hear much more of, and especially among women, actually, who typically have had less opportunity to amass significant nest eggs, and also in one case, of course, you had one who had one and lost it all.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they've usually had lower earnings than men all through life. But I think the important thing here is to recognize that, you know, Christopher said he had fantasies of the market bouncing back, and I think people need to keep in mind that it could go on kind of, you know, as it is now, bumping along for a long period of time, as you suggested.
And what does that suggest in terms of what retirees or would-be near retirees should be thinking, doing?
A radical rethinking of their plans, unfortunately. It's a very much an eat-your-spinach kind of message that's out there right now for people who are thinking of retiring at maybe 60 or 62.
And are you talking to a few people who didn't plan well, or are you talking to most Americans at that age?
I believe most Americans. I think people who planned well are being hit as much as others, and of course, obviously had a little bit higher expectations of what they might experience in retirement, but I think this is hitting everybody across the board. And if you just look back at the stock market, say 1968 to 84, 16-year period, it went nowhere. So we could be, I don't want to suggest we are, but we could be entering into a very long period of just kind of bumping around with no radical departures from where we are. So people are going to think differently about what they can afford to do and how soon they can afford to be off duty, so to speak.
That's exactly what we're looking at tonight with Claire Hushbeck from the AARP and Kevin Cahill from Boston College's Center for Retirement Research. We're talking about unretired America and the unprecedented flood of older Americans headed back into the workforce. You can join us. Did your retirement plans go down the drain with Wall Street? What dreams have you postponed to keep food on the table? And are the golden years, as we've known them, history? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about unretired America, the unprecedented flood of older Americans headed back into the workforce. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Kevin Cahill, Associate Director for Research at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, and from Arlington, Virginia, by Claire Hushbeck, a Senior Legislative Representative at the AARP and a labor economist. You can join us as well. What's it like to be 60-plus, 70-plus, 80, and still punching that clock? Have you postponed retirement dreams to keep food on the table? I guess, how are you planning your escape to retirement? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined right now from northeastern Massachusetts by Dick Wilcox, 62 years old, unemployed white-collar worker, laid off from his $65,000 mid-level insurance company job a year ago. And Dick, as I understand it, you would like to go back, may need to go back, and can't find a job.
Yeah, I think the topic that you're discussing is missing two very important groups of people.
Please share them.
One of them is the group I'm in, unemployed, 55 to 65, mm-hmm. never retired, may never be retired.
Mm-hmm.
The other group is people that have been retired but need to come back into the labor market and cannot because of age discrimination and several other factors.
Well, talk to us about what your experience has been. We know from the numbers that historic levels of older people are coming into the market, but that doesn't mean it's easier, that there's a good fit for everyone. What's your experience been like, Dick Wilcox?
Well, my experience has been in the last 13 months of searching for a job, as many as 700 resumes sent out with two interviews. I was featured in a front page article in the Wall Street Journal last Wednesday, mm-hmm. and the main topic of that was the fact that I had to go to the extreme of standing by the side of the road with a 4x6 foot sign saying I need a job with my phone number and my experience listed.
In the winter?
In the middle of the winter, yes, in outside of Boston. Very cold.
And what are you finding, Dick? You've clearly got a career of some length and accomplishment here. Are you getting interviews, or
no.
Are you up against younger people and they don't want to go for the older guy? Or what are you finding?
No. That's a mistake that nobody ever makes. No, you just don't get a call back. If you go for an interview and they're going to consider anybody else, they are seriously jeopardizing their chances of getting an age discrimination lawsuit.
Oh, so you say it's a mistake they won't make because when they see your age, they just don't get engaged with you for fear that they'll be accused later.
Which is perfectly legal.
Right.
You don't have to call anybody in. There's no requirement. But if you do call them in, if you do consider them, and you give the job to somebody else and they're not as qualified, you're in jeopardy.
So they
just don't call you in.
So what are you considering then, Dick? Because presumably at some point need will rear its ugly head very high. Are you thinking of changing the kind of work you're willing to do drastically?
Well, I have to, yeah, and I have to change my whole lifestyle, which doesn't necessarily mean I will have a less enjoyable retirement. It may mean that I will never retire and I will have a less enjoyable life because my wife, who now is a designer at home, will mm-hmm. have to go out of the home and work, mm-hmm. and something that she loves to do. She'll have to give that up.
Mm-hmm.
We only have one car. We'll probably have to work two different shifts. So instead of having what's, quote, called the golden years that we share together, for the first time in our lives, we probably won't see each other for most of the day.
What an truly unexpected way to be living. What kinds of jobs do you find yourself now considering, Dick Wilcox, that you wouldn't have before?
To tell you the truth, I haven't gotten to that point yet. I'm rearing my ugly head, and I'm roaring back.
Okay, we'll root for that then.
As Dylan Thomas said, do not go gently into that night. I'm not going to either. I have been on local TV, local talk radio. I was in the Boston Globe. I was the front page feature article in the Wall Street Journal.
The poster boy for here's a man full of gumption, fire, spitting vinegar at 62, needs a job, you ought to hire him.
Well, yeah. Well, not just me. There's a lot of them out there. There's a lot of them. The 600 phone calls I got, a lot of them were for people just like me that are capable of working, that want to work, that need to work, and because employers are being short-sighted and not talking to these people, what they're going to find out is 10 to 15 years from now, the job pool is going to shift to 48 to 60-year-old people. And the people they ignore today, they're going to be begging to come to work.
Yeah. Dick Wilcox, stand by. Kevin Cahill, what about that? We read that the demographics of the American population are going to change in such a way that we're going to have a much smaller ratio of workers to elders. We're going to need more older Americans working. If you look 10, 15 years out, are people in Dick Wilcox's age and situation going to be in high demand?
Well, there is going to be a slowing of the labor force due to the fact that the baby boomers are aging. One thing I'd like to mention is that a lot of the economics literature focuses on labor supply, and that's on the individual's decision to work and these different factors that come into account to determine whether mm-hmm. or not an individual should work at age 62 or age mm-hmm. 65. But there's another whole side to the story, and that's labor demand. And what will the employers do? I mean, these are the ones who are hiring workers. And that's a whole part of the story that's really understudied.
Well, that's
what
Dick is running up against here. What
does
it say? What does the reception he's getting say to you? That employers don't feel they need this age tier acutely yet, or?
Well, there are a lot of factors involved. One is age discrimination, which Dick mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Which is important, and his story is somewhat subtle. It's a different form of age discrimination. It's to the point where employers won't interview a candidate because they don't want to run the risk of bringing someone in and then being accused of age discrimination. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's the other there's another issue as well, and that's healthcare costs, and that older individuals do on average cost more, and that this may push up healthcare costs, and that's a concern on the part of the employer.
Oh yeah, Dick, Kevin, yes, Dick, are you there?
Yes. Could I make a point about
Please.
That? I have been in contact with Sandy Levin, who is a congressman from Michigan, mm-hmm. who currently is having hearings right now in Washington. In fact, I had Secretary Chow today from the Department of Labor, and we've been discussing some of the ideas that I had about changing the disincentive employers have to hire older workers because of the very cost of health care you're talking about.
So they don't have the same disincentive to look at older hires. Dick Wilcox, stand by. I want to welcome a caller on. Robin's calling from Sherburn, Massachusetts. Welcome, Robin. You're on the air. It sounds like you're interested in this very point or this area.
Yeah, actually, there's 2 points. By the way, thank you, Tom, for taking the call. You've got a great show.
Oh, thank you.
One point I think I wanted to make, if I could, on the technicality of the pension plan.
Okay.
Is that the individuals who are receiving a defined benefit pension can actually assume what they call a lump sum and then take those monies and invest it whatever way they want, similar to a defined contribution plan.
But a defined – why would a defined benefit person at this point in history want to take – want to walk away from that benefit and put it in the stock market or in a bank account where they get bupkis interest?
Yeah, I think what you found in the past few years is retirees taking lump sums, seeing the big returns in the marketplace, and looking at the wide eyes they might get from that return.
Doesn't sound like they're headed there now, but do I understand, Robin, that you employ seniors?
Yeah, actually, as a I work at a large financial services firm here in Boston. I think one of the things that we are looking at one side of the equation here is that it's certainly unfortunate that people have to retool and perhaps go back into a different career path and things, but we do hire seniors, and as a hiring manager, it's certainly one of the things that we look at as a skill and a talent to bring the pool back, because we know that the diversity is helping us as a set of managers here, and I think that's important to look at. That is a it's good for us. It's not a bad thing.
What are the elements of character, personality, experience, whatever that you see as a positive addition to diversity in bringing older workers in, Robin?
Typically, maturity is what adds quite a bit to a lot of team environments, where you have age range from, let's say, mid-20s up into the 50s, you'll find that that generates a very a stable teamwork to try to generate, you know, work and resolve issues.
And do you treat them right, or if they're old enough, do you put them in sort of backbench roles?
Treat them all the same. There's absolutely no reason to. I think you'll find that you might find some of the older folks, you know, pulling some of the younger folks along.
Right answer, Robin. Thanks for your call.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Dick Wilcox.
Robin,
Dick Wilcox is asking how old you are.
I'm 38.
That's right. Okay. You said older people, and you talked to up to mid-50s. That's not even the start of the problem. The start of the problem is after mid-50s. Are you hiring 65- and 70-year-olds?
At this point, I don't know all the age. I don't know the specific age of all the employees that we have. I just kind of gave a range.
Give me a call. I'd like a job. Okay.
Dick Wilcox, Northeastern Massachusetts, Robin. He's looking for a job, and it sounds like his background might fit. He's got a serious point there, and I wonder if you could just address it while we've got you. You make these hiring decisions. Let's not take you personally, because then we get into all that legal stuff. But do people in your situation, do they imagine casting the net out to folks who are 66, 67, 70?
Well, I think if I remember right, because I did read Dick's article or description in the journal the other day,
yes.
But there was an article, I think, in the Globe about a month ago about a firm on the Cape that hires only seniors and looks for only retirees and focuses only on that population. Mm-hmm. I forgot the name of the firm, but it was, I think, down in the Cape of Massachusetts.
Well, so we may have a retirement, not retirement, but relocation. Robin, thanks for your call. And Dick Wilcox, I want to thank you for joining us tonight and wish you the best of luck with your job hunt. It sounds like you're full of energy and deserve a job. I hope you get one soon.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Richard's calling from Boston. Welcome, Richard. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I am a retired stockbroker, having taken early retirement 3.5 years ago, my own volition. I was also a certified financial planner, and I was in the business for over 30 years.
Since we're on age tonight, Richard, do you mind sharing how your age with us?
Yes, I'm 62.
Okay, we've got it. So you're retired at 62. Good for you. What's your observation?
My observation is that, well, I have two observations. One is that I think the investment community has not done an effective enough job in terms of educating people who are thinking about retiring or who have recently retired.
What should they know that they don't, Richard?
I'm sorry?
What should they know that they don't? What should they have been told?
People should understand that they need to direct their investments toward income and not toward growth. The doctor who called from Oregon mentioned that his investment portfolio was down 40%.
Mm.
But my point is that if his investments had all been good dividend-paying stocks, even though his principal might have been down 40%, his income level wouldn't have suffered at all.
Well, good for him if he had that big chunk to begin with. But what about those trying to play catch-up who felt they needed big returns to retire?
Well, the other aspect to this is that the human resources people at the corporations have done a woefully inadequate job about providing good information for people who are about to retire in terms of how they should be investing their money. 58-year-old women should not be going into pre-IPO venture capital type securities. I was horrified to
That's for darn sure. And Carolyn Brady, who joined us from Boise, is paying very dearly for that. Now, Richard, thank you for calling with both of those thoughts. Claire Hushbeck, what about it? Looking forward here, you know, the Wall Street Journal also ran a little article the other day we saw.
Yeah.
It said, if you want to retire, the only way to do it is to outrun the bear. Bear's chasing two people. The only one who, you know, all that matters is that you're faster than the other guy. You have to save more than others in the retirement cohort to be able to be the one on the beach.
Yes. Well, we are notorious undersavers in this country. Always have been, actually. It's not just the boomers who are guilty of that. And we actually had gotten pretty accustomed to thinking in terms of 25 or 30 years of leisure at the end of life as being the norm. I think we're rethinking that now. Certainly for the mass of the population, that was not a sustainable goal for 76 million boomers to be able to do that.
Kevin Cahill, but that's not a message that boomers want to hear.
They don't. No, clearly, they don't. It
Agreed.
Is an eat your spinach message.
But is it really changing? Kevin, do we have to accept, hey, I'm going to be working when I'm 65, 75, 78, I don't know, 80, right up to the lights go out?
It seems that earnings is certainly going to play a more important role in retirement income for a lot of reasons. One reason which we've discussed are this change in the value of equities. There's also changes in Social Security, which are important to keep in mind, and that's that the normal retirement age is going to increase to age 67 for individuals turning 62 by 2022. So there are changes in Social Security, there are changes in private pensions, and there's been very little savings. So I guess the answer is yes. People will be relying on earnings in the future.
Claire Hushbeck, we've just got 10 seconds, but do you see people finding a way to accept this with grace and enjoy those years anyway?
Yes, I do, but I also see this as an opportunity to work against the age discrimination that is very much alive and well that a couple of callers have referred to. I think that is one of the last remaining biases in the workplace that is going to be kissed goodbye.
We're going to see pressure on that soon. Claire Hushbeck,
okay.
Thank you for joining us tonight.
All right, thank you.
Claire Hushbeck is with the AARP, and Kevin Cahill from the Research for the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Thank you for being with us. It's been great having you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Good luck retiring someday. This is On Point. This is WBU.